The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, nice to be here. Perhaps we could say that we're all philosophers of happiness. That may not be how you think of yourself, but at some level we've all adopted a kind of model of the good life, a way of being happy. And probably some aspects of the philosophy that we hold are conscious to us, and probably some aspects we've adopted maybe without seeing them so clearly. And I think in a way, we all actually have a pretty abiding loyalty to our particular philosophy of happiness, to our model of what the good life is. And part of what meditation practice is doing is we get to examine, like, what is it that I actually believe brings happiness? And one of the things that I think we find is that we have some faith that clinging is going to work, you know. And the tricky thing about this is that clinging in some ways does work. It kind of works to bring some happiness. And yet, the Buddha said that clinging ultimately can't fulfill the deepest longings of the heart. And so some of what we're doing in Buddhist practice is maybe we could say examining some of the pros and cons of clinging, learning some of the delights of letting go. I was at a talk by Joseph Goldstein a few years ago, and at the end of the talk he took questions, and a questioner got up and said, you know, 10 years ago I saw you and at a talk, and I asked you to summarize the entirety of the Dharma, all of the Buddhist teachings, in one sentence. And what you said then, 10 years ago, was anything can happen anytime. And then the questioner went on to say, you know, that was 10 years ago. You're 10 years older. You've done 10 more years of practice, of teaching. How would you characterize freedom now? What would you say if you had to say it in one sentence? And Joseph said, the mind that's not clinging to anything. And he goes on to say that there are a lot of differences between the traditions, between insight meditation and Zen and Tibetan practice, but none of the schools of Buddhism say cling. This is shared deeply, right? So this is Rumi. There's a way of loving not attached to what is loved. Observe how water is with the ground always moving toward the ocean, though the ground tries to hold water's foot and not let it go. This is how we are with wine and beautiful food, wealth and power, or just a dry piece of bread. We want and get drunk with wanting, then the headache and bitterness afterward. A love with no object is a true love, all else shadow without substance. Have you seen someone fall in love with his own shadow? That's what we've done. Leave partial loves and find the one that's whole. Now, from that kind of quote, it gives the sense maybe that maybe we could pick that up and feel like clinging is the enemy. But in the realm of experience, there are no enemies. There's just suffering and freedom from suffering. There are no enemies. And on this recent retreat with Gil that I sat with, I see a couple familiar faces from that retreat, his two-week retreat at IRC. He talked about, it was all about clinging in some ways. The whole retreat was about self-clinging. And at one point late in the retreat, he said something that really struck me. He said that we need to have a certain level of respect, awe, maybe even reverence for our own clinging, for the depth and power of it. And I really, appreciate that. Because the truth is, as I said, it kind of works. Clinging kind of works. And so we can't be all that harsh with ourselves for repeating it. Now, the way we... when we come to meditation practice, we, of course, don't leave all of that behind. Even though the practice, even though in an important sense, meditation practice, we're literally practicing or rehearsing non-clinging. Like, that's what we do on the cushion. But it's a practice. It's we can't just stop clinging. The opportunity with meditation, though, is actually to see how this happens, to see the mechanisms by which we do cling. Because we do meditation the way we do everything else, right? It's not like meditation is something different. So this is Ajahn Chah. Simplify your meditation practice down to just two words. Let go. Rather than try to develop this practice and then develop that and achieve this and go into that and understand this and read the suttas and study the Abhidhamma and then learn Pali and Sanskrit, then the Madhyamaka and the Prajnaparamita, get ordinations in the Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, write books and become a world-renowned authority on Buddhism. Instead of becoming the world's expert on Buddhism and being invited to great international Buddhist conferences, just let go. I did nothing but this for 2 years. Every time I tried to understand or figure things out, I'd say, let go, until the desire would fade out. So I'm making it very simple for you to save you from getting caught in incredible amounts of suffering. There's nothing more sorrowful than having to attend international Buddhist conferences. Some of you might have the desire to become the Buddha of the age, Maitreya, radiating love throughout the world. But instead, I suggest being an earthworm, letting go of the desire to radiate love throughout the world. Just be an earthworm who only knows two words, let go, let go, let go. So You know, the illusion is that we actually have a choice to let go or hold on. We're all, you know, the nature of this life is that we need to let go. It's not going to be a choice. And in reflecting on this, I think about my dad, who has been, I would say, very successful in clinging in a lot of ways, in the sense that he's clung to health and vitality and academic achievement. And he's been successful in all those ways. And yet, so, like all at the same time, it hit him that he's not going to be able to hold on forever. He's not going to be able to do it. You know, that the world is like begging us to let go. And we get to practice here on the cushion, we get to practice in retreat, we get to practice when what we hold dear is not being taken from us. We actually get to practice letting go. One of Ajahn Chah's students, Ajahn Amaro, said 80% of the practice is knowing that we need to let go, but not being able to do it. And I can say, even after all these thousands of hours of meditation practice, I'm not even totally sure what it is to let go. And it's, I think, an ongoing question for us in practice. But we can begin to attend to the anxiety of clinging, the peace of letting go, and the cultivation of equanimity and wisdom. Now, clinging, the attachment, that feverish thirst, is different from desire. You know, sometimes the Buddha's second noble truth, like desire is the cause of all suffering, it gets translated, the word tanha in Pali gets translated as desire. Desire is suffering or something. And that's a bad translation, according to a lot of Pali scholars. Desire can be distinguished from craving and clinging insofar as desires can actually be fulfilled. Whereas clinging, craving, is always bigger than its object. It can never be satiated. Even when we get that which is sought after, that which we want to hold, the craving, the clinging, is bigger than its object. It cannot be satisfied. So the Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Tejani, Andrea's teacher, was asked, if you can like something and it not be a form of clinging. And what he said was, when wisdom wants something, there's no agitation, there's no urge to get there immediately. It understands the proximate causes to attain the goal and will work steadily to fulfill them. Wisdom always sees both sides, the good and the bad. It sees things from different perspectives. And so you can hear how that characterization of wisdom wanting something is so different than the feverish thirst of clinging, of trying to hold the world still. And part of what keeps clinging in place is that it operates, you know, beneath the radar of awareness. And the Buddha said that we need to actually sometimes just seeing clinging, just bringing that into the clarity of awareness is actually sufficient to let go. But when it's under the radar of awareness, when, for example, all of our cravings and clingings are, we're moment by moment trying to gratify them, and a lot of times it works out. Like, I can go get a slice of pizza, you know. They'll sell it to me, you know. Nothing wrong with pizza. I'm just saying, like, this is an example. Like, I can get it. And if I do that every time I want a piece of pizza, it actually obscures the mechanisms of clinging that are operating inside me, right? I can't really see with clarity what's happening in me, what the pizza does accomplish and what it doesn't. So, the Buddha directs us to four places to look for where clinging arises. And the first is sense pleasure. So we're on the topic of pizza. And I'm not dismissive of pleasure. A life with a lot of physical, emotional pleasure, that's of value. I'm not dismissive of that. You know, it's not like people become enlightened and then they choose dirt over pizza, you know, or something, right? So we don't have to be dismissive of that, but we also have to look with a kind of clear eyes, like, what has the enormous amount of pleasure that most of us have experienced in our lives, what has it done for us and what has it left incomplete? This is what I was alluding to in talking about the clinging being bigger than the object. And so much of the time with sense pleasure, when we're reaching out towards sense pleasure, what we want more than the actual pleasure is the cessation of the clinging. Like, that's part of the relief. It's like the clinging fades out or is muted when we get the object. And the Buddha said, basically, let's not take the circuitous route through the pizza to less clinging. Let's just move to less clinging. The views, so sense pleasure, views. Maybe you know that sense at the end of a sitting sometimes. Maybe it's been a relatively quiet sitting for you, and the room is quiet. And in those moments, there's really, there's so little pressure to say anything or be anything or advance any views. You know, we just feel kind of quiet. We certainly are not in the mood to have a debate, to convince somebody of what's true and what's not. The energy for all of that just isn't there. It's quiet. Whatever views we have, they're held loosely in those kinds of moments, right? But that's a flavor of freedom and ease, and it's not always like that, right? We do get attached to views, attached to being right. This is from Catherine Schultz, who wrote a book titled Being Wrong. Why is it so fun to be right? As pleasures go, it is, after all, a second-order one at best. Unlike many of life's other delights, chocolate, surfing, kissing, it does not enjoy any mainline access to our biochemistry. And yet the thrill of being right is undeniable, universal, and almost entirely undiscriminating. We can't enjoy kissing just anyone, but we can relish being right about almost anything. Our indiscriminate enjoyment of being right is matched by an almost equally indiscriminate feeling that we are right. Most of us go through life assuming that we are basically right, basically all the time, about basically everything. As absurd as it sounds when we stop to think about it, our steady state seems to be one of unconsciously assuming that we are very close to omniscient, all-knowing. If we relish being right and regard it as our natural state, you can guess how we feel about being wrong. For one thing, we tend to view it as a rare and bizarre. For another, it leaves us feeling ashamed. Of all the things we are wrong about, this error might well top the list. We are wrong about what it means to be wrong. Far from being a sign of intellectual inferiority, the capacity to err is crucial to human cognition. Far from being a moral flaw, it is inextricable from some of our most humane and honorable qualities. And far from being a mark of indifference or intolerance, wrongness is a vital part of how we learn and change. Thanks to error, we can revise our understanding of ourselves and amend our ideas of the world. However disorienting, difficult, or humbling our mistakes might be, it is ultimately wrongness, not rightness, that can teach us who we are. So much of the Dharma is really about being wrong. That sounds wrong itself, but so much of it, so much of the Dharma is like we're coming out of old understandings. I thought I knew who I was. I thought I knew what my problems were. I thought I knew what the solutions were. I thought I knew what the Dharma was. And being really light and flexible, unattached to being right, flexible about being wrong, about seeing wrongness, is indispensable on the path. So many times I've gotten like settled into a particular view of the Dharma, of what Buddhism is, of what happiness is. And then something happens, something gets shaken up. And our whole view of ourself, the world, practice changes. And this is wholesome. This is actual spiritual progress. And it's disorienting, and it takes a while to find our sea legs with it. But this is actually what Dharma practice is about. Oscar Wilde said, "The secret of life is to appreciate the pleasure of being terribly, terribly deceived." Sense pleasure, views, conventions. So much of what we do feels so natural all the time, in the sense that the way we do, we have a loyalty to the way we do things. And we tend to think that there's a kind of natural order to how we do things and how we dress and how we behave and what we believe. And But it's a, you know, our lives are a dependent arising. They are shaped by many, many forces outside ourselves. And so much of what feels like just the natural way to do things is really kind of strange idiosyncratic conventions. And you start to see this, I think, especially in travel, when you see how other people do things, and it's very different than how you might or I might. And it becomes a little bit clear, like, whoa, it's I do things in a distinctive way, and I guess they are kind of conventions in a way that I've inherited. And sometimes we're attached to them, sometimes not. I was thinking of an example for this, and the debates over gay marriage, I think, highlight kind of attachment to conventions. Insofar as when I listen to the opposition to marriage equality, when you get down strip down the argument, much of the time I found to be the opposition to gay marriage is something like, but this isn't how we do things, you know? And attachment to that kind of convention obscures what's right in front of you, which may be two people who love each other. The last place of clinging is self-view, sakkaya ditti. The Buddha says, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. And we can put down the debates, the philosophical debates, whether there's a self or no self or something. We can just put that down. And we can look at the ways in which insisting on ourself as this or that complicates our life, compromises our spontaneity, our effectiveness in the world, the ways in which we can find ourselves sort of standing guard at the gates of self, protecting ourselves against contradictory evidence. But this is hard because the world is a big ego challenge in some ways. The world will challenge whatever fixed ideas we have about ourselves. And we have to learn to be very flexible in how we relate to ideas of self. Otherwise, we become brittle and our attachment to self-view, the ways in which we protect our view of self, creates a kind of egoic pressure that we exert on the world, on others. So letting go, it's said that some patterns of clinging are, it's like written in water, some are written in sand, and some in granite, you know, like some of our habits of clinging. And sometimes just looking, sometimes just a deep breath is enough to let go. And then sometimes it takes some sustained effort. some of what we're doing in being careful with our conduct, with sort of aligning with harmlessness, is that we're creating fewer potential places of clinging. Much of the path of letting go, we're like gradually backing our way out of the little karmic corner, planting the seeds for letting go, planting the seeds for not picking up in the first place. In my experience, in the actual act of letting go, maybe most important is pointed to by the teachings on dependent origination, where the Buddha describes the mechanisms by which suffering arises and tries to unpack that, the engine of suffering. And what he highlights in there is that links between feeling, vedana, feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, linked with craving and clinging. And I think we could say that if there were no feeling, there would be no craving, no clinging. If there were no feeling. Now, we can't suppress feeling. There's times in practice when the vedana is pervasively neutral, and that's there's no problems when it's like that. But in general, there's going to be the flow of pleasure, of pleasant and unpleasant. And we're going to need to learn to work with that, to short-circuit the cycle of feeling, craving, clinging. And for me, the most important dimension of practice has been to learn to be able to absorb the impact of feeling on the body. You know, we have bodies that are sensitive in this way. We can feel this or the temperature of the air or something. But then we also have a kind of body that's emotionally responsive. So if we heard a loud noise now, many of us would have like some kind of fear reaction, right? We would probably feel it in our bodies. It would alert us to something, right? And it's, I think, the same way with all emotional states, that there's a fingerprint in the body, and to short-circuit craving or clinging, to let go, requires having equanimity with feeling in the body. And this is tricky because it's intense. It's intense. Feeling is intense. It's like evolutionarily designed to get our attention and get us to do something. And to develop a very open-hearted, flexible relationship to it, to allow it, to tolerate it, to accept it, to not manipulate it it's a practice to be developed. And being in the midst of intense feeling is like being buffeted with very strong winds. But what we're trying to learn is that nothing can be blown over. The winds of feeling, they appear like they're going to break something inside of us. Like something's going to get blown over. But what we're learning with this practice of equanimity with feeling is to see, to know, to develop confidence in our own heart that nothing can be blown over. That mindfulness can keep us safe in the midst of these winds of feeling. that it will hurt, but it will not break something. You know, I think of like those trees in Florida in a hurricane, and you see footage and they're like bowed way over, and it really looks like they could break, and they do. An intense feeling is like that. It seems like something's going to break in us unless we obey. And the practice of equanimity is to develop some confidence that that nothing will break inside of us. Now, sometimes we'll try everything we can to let go. We'll sort of like do all of our, we'll try all of our, the tools in the Dharma toolkit, all of our Dharma karate moves kind of on the clinging, and nothing will work. We'll feel just like nothing will work. And in these moments, if we're up for it, and it takes a little bit of energy, but if we're up for it, those moments we can actually try to just stay with it. And what the feeling is when we're backed into that corner of clinging and we just cannot let go, the feeling is something like one of helplessness, which is about the most difficult thing to tolerate for humans. And the opportunity, at least some of the time, is to stay open, at least somewhat open, to that sense of being helpless, of not being able to do anything with the craving, with the clinging, to stay open to that, and to let that actually kind of soak in a way which it won't feel good, but it builds a deep motivation to develop more freedom, to cultivate the path. It's an onward leading experience. And the other thing that encounter with some helplessness does is that it highlights the just necessity of compassion. The necessity of compassion for ourselves and for others. So this is Rumi again. Gamble everything for love. If you are a true human being, half-heartedness doesn't reach into majesty. You set out to find God, but then you keep stopping for long periods at mean-spirited roadhouses. Don't wait any longer. Dive in the ocean. Leave and let the sea be you. Silent. Absent, walking an empty road, all praise. Thank you.